This week on Writers, Inc.
I feel very confident in the science and history and telling a good story that's about an idea. I didn't feel nearly as confident in, frankly, my writing as I did my storytelling.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So we had a very fun morning here. So my daughter, for like the last year, her and her friends have been plotting to create what they call the haunted forest behind our house. Like we own the woods behind our house, and like they want to turn it into this haunted thing for Halloween. So last year at basically right before Spirit Halloween closed, my daughter and I went in and we bought up like all the animatronics they had left. And we ended up with eight of them. So I spent all day yesterday setting up these eight animatronics, and like I didn't want to put them out in the woods yet because obviously we're like 3 weeks away from Halloween and they would fall apart. So I put them under this breezeway that's, you know, between our house and the garage. And then like around 3 o'clock in the morning, our alarm went off. And we have a monitoring company where if something gets triggered, like our monitoring people can log into our security cameras and they can, you know, they can yell at whoever is out there, or they can call the police or whatever based on what they find. But apparently they saw these like the shadows of animatronics on the security cameras, thought that they were actually people in the breezeway, and then called the police. So like we had the police out here like in the middle of the night. It was,
oh my god,
it was
incredible.
Yeah, it was fun. So I mental note, I need to move those, I guess, is the moral of the story after we finish up the podcast to make sure it doesn't happen again tonight.
That's wow.
Yeah. I was explaining to Christine before we started recording, like she's got this love-hate relationship with these things. Like when we go to the store, she doesn't want to go anywhere near them. Like she stands like halfway down the aisle and makes me walk up and press the little button to make them go off. And like the other night she had a bad dream where like they all came to life and they climbed up through her bedroom window. So like, I'm not even sure why she wants these in the house, but like she's been pushing for me to set them up.
Well,
so
because fear is an interesting thing, and you know, it's good that she's willing to wrestle with it.
Yeah.
You see, there's like a house in God, I want to say like North Carolina that has like they have like the fog machine and all the windows are like flickering and it looks like the whole house is on fire. And it's so realistic that the fire department keeps getting called.
Oh boy.
Like, the house is on fire.
That stuff does look real. So we've got a smoke machine we put on our front porch and another one that we put on the rooftop deck. So like we've got, and it kind of trickles down over the house. So it looks like fire. And I've got a, it's like a sound activated lightning thing that I set up in the windows, and I just turn on a, you know, the news on a TV, and like, that's enough to trigger like random flashes of light. So it looks like lightning going on in the house. Halloween is fun. We have a good time with it.
It's not really fun.
Not 3 o'clock in the morning at the beginning of October.
Well, no, that's not fun. But
all right, what's going on with you guys? Anything?
We've been people who listen to my other podcast and follow me on Substack know that Kara and I have decided to downsize.
Yeah.
And so we've been packing everything, and we're probably, it's looking pretty likely, we will be in the van, but we may not be in the van as full time as I thought we were going to be, because we've got now like invitations to stay at certain places. And she has an interior design client in Pittsburgh. So we get to stay in their guest house for like 3 or 4 months while the remodel happens. So, but then we're looking at maybe trying to get, we've decided there's a place here in Austin called The Domain, and it's just like awesome outdoor town center mall thing, and they've got these great apartments that are all walking distance from like coffee shops and restaurants and, you know, shopping and whatever. So we went and looked at some of those over the weekend. We think we found the one we want, but it'll be like 6 months before we actually move into it.
Nice.
So, yeah,
that's cool though, because then you get a little break and do some travel. And
That's what we're thinking. And you know, we're downsizing and our overhead goes down with it. And so we'll actually be free to do a lot more traveling. And, you know, we're looking at maybe trying to go to Greece at some point and, you know, other things. But right now it's just a lot of packing. Man, you don't realize how emotionally attached you are to things until you start like breaking it down to
Oh,
sell it or discard it or
I
yeah.
love it. I love getting rid of stuff. I don't know what's wrong with me. I
We're
like when
getting
I
better
can
at it.
go on and just pitch everything. Like, I haven't
Because
seen you for a
you're.
year out the door.
I like getting rid of things, but there are some things that, yeah, it's not that easy.
Yeah. My wife and I, when we downsized from Florida and we bought that duplex in Pittsburgh, you know, we got rid of almost everything that we had. And now, you know, like it's 11, 12 years later or whatever. And the only thing I regret actually getting rid of were the books, because we
Yeah.
had tons of books and like it's a pain in the ass to move books. So like we boxed them up and I kept like the ones that I thought were my favorites. But like, you know, I wish I would have that's the only thing I probably would have, you know, put in storage, like
Yeah.
back
Books
and
are
do it
the
all
hood
over
thing.
again.
I struggle with that too.
Yeah, like everything else, I don't miss any of the other
Kids'
stuff, you know,
artwork
like
in the
all.
trash. Books, got to
Yeah.
keep those.
Wow.
No, kid, no, that we've got boxes and we will keep, but yeah, but like trinkets and like all the junk that you fill up, you know, like around your house, like
This
all of that,
the
like you forget that
detritus
it
of
even exists.
life. Yeah.
Yeah, like you don't need any of it. And what you're gonna find too is like, you know, or at least we did when we moved back into another house, you know, we didn't repurchase that kind of stuff again. 'Cause like we,
Yeah.
you know, once you've been through that, you realize it is meaningless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why spend $30 or $40 or $100 on this or that? 'Cause you don't
Yeah.
care, you know?
And I mean, we're going from, you know, this place is like 2,500 square foot. It's just too big for two people and a chihuahua, you know? So we're committed. We're having the first of several garage sales next weekend. But we've been selling. Look, if you want to experience the ninth circle of hell, sell stuff on Facebook Marketplace, because that people are insane and they do stuff like, "Is this still available?" And you say yes, and then they just disappear, or
Yeah.
they say, "I'm really interested. Where do I pick it up?" And you tell them, and they disappear. So it's just.
Have you had any ask you to bring it to them?
Oh, I've
Like,
had
I'm 20
several.
minutes away. Can you drive it over to me?
Yeah, I've had several. And I was very explicit in my listings saying, look, you're gonna have to pick it up, bring a truck. Last night we had a couple come to get like this mat. We sold this like faux fireplace and a couple of bookcases and a coffee table to this couple. I said, it's a lot of stuff, it's big. Bring a truck, bring some help, bring some blankets. They showed up in a Kia. So
Perfect.
they had to come back with a U-Haul.
Yeah.
But another couple
Wow.
showed up with a U-Haul. It was this massive U-Haul for like one item. They didn't have any rope, any blankets. So I'm like digging through my stuff, you know, because I know they're gonna get it home all busted and broken and then blame me and try to get their money back, you know.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. Wow.
Fun times.
on the flip side, I've discovered the joy of Venmo. I like Venmo a lot.
All right, man. What is in the news?
Well, first up, chaos at Baker & Taylor as Ingram adds staff in light of impending closure. Baker & Taylor is shutting down by January 1st after the Readerlink sale collapsed. Layoffs are underway, operations are winding down, and it's unclear if orders will ship, refunds will be issued, or inventory will be returned, leaving libraries and more than 250 small presses suddenly without a key distributor. Inside Baker and Taylor, employees describe chaos. Five waves of layoffs began October 6th. Health insurance ended immediately, and staff say they have little guidance on the wind down or what to tell customers. Ingram is moving to absorb the fallout, adding 40 to 50 staff across operations, sales, and integrations, onboarding over 1,000 library accounts, and rolling out a new cataloging and processing system to get shelf-ready customers live in weeks.
So I can vouch for this because Baker and Taylor is one of my distributors, and I have yet to
Yeah.
receive a single email explaining any of this. All the
Same.
information I've gotten has all come from third parties and you know, news outlets.
Yeah,
Yeah.
same here.
It's concerning. Like, the libraries are right now kind of in limbo, and it looks like Ingram is moving in to pick up some of that stuff, but Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening.
Quite a coup for Ingram, though.
Yeah, it's good for Ingram.
Yeah, I think they're going to pick up quite a bit of business because of this. I haven't heard anything from Direct Digital yet, or maybe I have and I haven't noticed it, but I should reach out to them and ask them. But Baker and Taylor was such a big deal. It's just shocking the way this is being handled, though, man. I mean, it's not like they couldn't have known, and they were that dependent on the ReaderLink sale to save the day. I mean, employees are suddenly without insurance and sudden
Yeah.
layoffs and things. I mean, this is just, yeah, this is terrible.
That's how this goes. You know, like the key employees, they know what's going on, so they start to bail before anything goes bad. And then
Yeah.
you're left with the people that don't know what's happening or the ones that don't know how to handle it. And then they start to bail. And before you know it, the lower level employees, nobody's told them anything, and they're just kind of stuck dealing in the aftermath. It's always
Yeah.
a mess when a company falls apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, my rule was always I get paid or I own stuff that was in my cubicle. That was always my rule. Computers, monitors, that stuff goes with me until I get paid.
That's actually a good point, because the way Baker and Taylor works is like I have to invoice them to get paid. And
Yeah.
I usually do that on a monthly basis. And like I should probably, you know, hit them for
Oh,
one last
yeah.
check just to make sure.
That's a
Yeah.
good
Like I
point. Okay. Yeah. We need to
because
look into
it's on my
that.
calendar as like a to-do thing, but like I don't think it's gonna come up for like another 2 weeks or something. I should probably just do it now.
Yep.
This bothers
Oh.
me. All
Yep.
right. So, what books do readers find most confusing? Auraprint scanned popular books on Goodreads with at least 50,000 reviews and counted how often readers use the word confusing in their reviews. The study was done September 24th, 2025. Most confusing titles, quotes, skewed heavily to fantasy and romanticy, and most were by women authors, likely a mix of completely world building and sheer popularity, putting them in more hands. By contrast, romance and thrillers were least often called confusing.
I mean, I think that makes sense. Like, thrillers and romance tend to be like there are very specific beats that you have to hit.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I think they go in, you know, expecting those beats. And as long as you hit them, you're good. But with fantasy, I mean, the world building, sci-fi too, like that can get intense.
Yeah.
That can get muddy. Yeah, some of the other stuff that I've learned over the years that really throws the readers off is if you time jump, and I love to do it, you know, like this
Yeah.
chapter's in the past, this one's in the future, this one's present or whatever. So you have to just make sure you label these things very clearly. I've been putting, you know, like when I've got multiple points of view in a book, I just put the name of the character whose point of view it is at the start of every
Yeah.
chapter now. You know, the old rule used to be you would start the chapter like the first sentence would include, you know, the name of the character who's holding that point of view.
Yeah.
But now you need it in big letters right there next to the chapter number or people get
Right.
confused. So,
Right.
you know.
You remember the movie Funny Farm with Chevy Chase? And so there was a scene where she finally read his book and he was waiting eagerly and he'd poured wine for them and everything. And she's like, it was just confusing. It was flashbacks and flashbacks within flashbacks and flash forwards and a flash sideways at one point. So that's my guiding light on keeping things from being confusing now.
Well, and I think fantasy also tends to have a bigger cast of characters, right?
Yeah.
Like thrillers might have a, you know, a decent cast, but a lot of them die. So like at least it gets whittled down at the end, you're kind of still left with a core group. Whereas, I mean, depending on the fantasy, you could have 50 characters that you have to keep track of.
I have read some fantasy that I have found very confusing. It's meandering. I'm like, who is this character? I still like
Yeah, and if
it.
you can't pronounce the name, then like that, you
I
know,
can't
that's
pronounce this
the
name.
enemy.
I forget who this person
Yeah.
is. I forget
Right.
where we are in this story. What does this have to do with the main plot? I still love it. I don't care.
Oh, no,
Immerse
I
me in
love
that
it. Yeah.
meandering stuff.
I
Confuse
just
me.
think that that report makes a lot of sense.
It makes sense to me too, just from the type, right? Because yeah, it's not a straightforward narrative drive often in fantasy and sci-fi.
Yeah.
I think if you feel the need to put a map at the very beginning of your book to explain everything, then you're probably going down a dark path and you might want to take a step back for a beat.
Here's my hot take. I never read the maps or the lists of characters in fantasy books. I don't care. I don't need to know where I am. It's none of my
Yeah.
business.
See, I think I'm convinced that George R. R. Martin only wrote three characters in the whole Game of Thrones series, and just teleport from place to place. Because they all, I can't differentiate a single name, not from the books, not from the TV show. Can't, don't know who's, don't know who does what. Jon Snow's the only name I know. It's the only one.
Khaleesi, I remember that one.
Khaleesi. That's the second character. That's it. That's pretty
You're
much it.
Kevin,
Tyrion.
you're
That's number
insane.
three.
That's just my final verdict.
I'm insane. I'm insane. George R. R. Martin writes the Game of Thrones. What is it called? Song of Ice and Fire. But I'm the one that's insane. That's fine. That's fair. Speaking of insanity, how TikTok keeps its users scrolling for hours a day. The Washington Post analyzed real watch histories from 800 US TikTok users and 15 million videos. Light users doubled their time to about 70 minutes a day within months, while power users stayed at 4 hours plus. Habit formation can start roughly in 35 minutes. TikTok's endless personalized feed trains faster swiping and more frequent opens, creating binge and craving loops. Brain studies suggest stronger reward responses and lower self-control when the feed is tailored. If you want to cut back, turn off notifications, set strict screen time limits, or delete the app from your phone and use desktop only. Add friction and use social media actively to connect rather than passively scrolling.
This is scary. Like it hooks you in 35 minutes. Like that's,
35 minutes.
I'd love to see somebody's brain being monitored like live as they see TikTok for the very first time, just to see all this kind of stuff play out. I'm trying to think of like if I've done this, because I've been on TikTok, I've scrolled TikTok, but I don't think I go for more like maybe 15 minutes or something a day at the most. And that's like just on the days that I use it. But I can't imagine, 4 hours.
Four
That's
hours.
insane.
4 hours is a lot. I do know that when I'm tired, I will sort of be more susceptible to like just sort of like letting just that constant feed, just kind of go and go and go. If I'm not like tired or burned out, it's very easy to walk away. But I do notice I have to be careful if I'm very tired.
When I'm cognitively low, that's also like when I get sucked in. I blame Jenna though, because she sends me funny memes, so I have to find ones to send back.
He sends them back.
See, I just when people forward that stuff to me, I just send back LOL, and then I never once even look at what they send me. I just know that that response will work.
I know that people don't look at stuff that I send them because we'll talk about it later and they have no clue. So that stops some of that. I like the idea of forcing yourself to do it only for engagement, to for connect. I'm really bad at that. Like I look at stuff without engaging at it at all. So I gotta
Oh, I
challenge
do
myself
that
on that.
too. Like I'll send things to you, but I won't like them.
I don't
And then
like it either. I'll send you
I'll
it.
catch myself and be like, why am I not? I don't know.
That idea of creating friction is actually really good. That's grounded in the whole, good habit, bad habit thing. And I use techniques like that a lot to break bad habits. And that idea of take the app off your phone, that really helps a lot, because I'm probably not going to even do any of that on the computer.
No,
Like,
on the desktop, not
oh,
at all.
yeah. It is a
So,
phone thing. It's the ease, maybe, of,
yeah.
like you're on your couch and you're tired or you're in bed and it's just very easy. But yeah, if I really like, just take everything off the phone and then suddenly zero time on social media, like zero urge on a laptop, which is very interesting how, like what changes based on the device you're using.
I don't have time for TikTok. I've got too much porn to watch. But anyway, that's the news.
All right.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
Yeah, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got AG Riddle coming on. AG spent 10 years starting and stopping running international companies before retiring to focus on his passion, which was writing fiction. He's the author of 13 novels that have sold over 6 million copies worldwide in 20 languages. He's kind of one of those guys that seems to have a crystal ball and knows what's going on in the publishing industry. I'm curious to hear what he's up to. AG Riddle.
I have been chasing this gentleman for at least 10 years, Jerry.
Wait a decade.
So I'm talking to AG Riddle. You might know him from such things as the Atlantis Gene. What would you classify yourself as? A sci-fi thriller writer? Is that a thing?
I think sci-fi thriller is fair. I mean, some of the stuff a little more sci-fi than thriller, but yeah.
Yeah. What do you consider yourself when in your head when you're thinking about your career? What is it that you think?
I guess sci-fi thriller, although I think that early in my career is maybe a little more sci-fi thriller, maybe a little more sci-fi now.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the last couple have been pretty sci-fi. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a lot of your work is Quantum Radio was, right? Did I get the title right?
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
okay. Yeah. Yeah. I read that recently-ish, I guess, right after it came out. And that one's got that very strong.
I saw your
one-star
review. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not enough quantum in that is what I was thinking.
We can do more quantum in the next one.
Yeah. What I love, and you know, I kind of wish we had started recording earlier, because before we got on, you had noticed it, like, in the backdrop of my office here. I've got a framed blueprint of the Enterprise D from Star Trek: The Next Generation. So we geeked out a little bit about our mutual love of Star Trek.
Me too.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, no one's going to see that that you held up, but he's got like the patent drawing for the Enterprise.
I'm still learning how audio works and podcasting.
No, it's fine. It's fine. You know, if you bothered to show up for the Wordslinger podcast every now and then, we'd have video. But no, I'm going to stop giving you a hard time on that, man. Yeah. So
only 9 years late.
9 years. All right, so sci-fi thriller is an interesting category. What kind of brought you around on that? What's the origin story for you on this stuff?
Well, I think a lot of it is what I like to read, but I do read in a couple of genres. And I guess when I started my career, it's the genre that I felt there was the most demand for and need from readers. And it's something I felt like I could do. I also think, to a certain degree, you know, sci-fi thrillers and especially techno thrillers are very idea driven to a certain degree. And they're also, the readers can be fairly forgiving on a lot of things. I mean, if you get facts wrong, yeah, that's, you know, that's a big problem. But, you know, in terms of pacing or character development or dialogue and some of the things that I felt like I would get better at in my career, I thought this is a great place to start, because I feel very confident in the science and history and telling a good story that's about an idea.
Yeah.
I didn't feel nearly as confident in, frankly, my writing as I did my storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah. What, let's talk about how you came to this though. Like, how did you come in? Now, how long had you been dreaming about writing? What did it take to get you here?
Well, it's a interesting story, because I started an internet company in college, and I did that for, I don't know, 12 years. And I would characterize my career as like moderately successful. I was like middling, if you will. It wasn't exactly a standout, but I had done well enough to take some time and figure out what I really wanted to do. And what I loved in my life was reading. And especially when the Kindle came, I had always been a reader my whole life, but when the Kindle was released, I was really able to read with in a routine way that I never had before, because I could never find enough books that I enjoyed. And, you know, with the Kindle, I could, and it was very convenient. I didn't have to leave my house. And so I started reading self-published books on Kindle.
Yeah.
And I had never really thought about trying to write a book. And I mean, I grew up in a very small town in North Carolina, and it just wasn't like I didn't know any writers. And this wasn't like a real career. I mean, I went to UNC Chapel Hill, and like people would talk, oh, I'm going to go write the great novel. But everyone's like, man, you need to get a job. Like, it just really wasn't a thing right, that people did, or that anyone that I knew. But anyway, I think when I first started reading self-published author's own Kindle, I thought, man, this is something I'm going to take some time and give it a try. But as I went into the career, I went in with sort of these expectations, like this is still kind of a lark. Like this is, you know,
Yeah.
a long shot that could work, and it likely won't. And yeah, here I am 12
Yeah.
years later.
Yeah. Yeah. And you pulled it off, right? I mean,
My wife is still very suppressed.
really?
But
Yeah.
no, she.
Good to have this faith of the spouse behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So was there a time when you, I mean, did you come to any point where you had doubt that it was going to work out?
Early, there was a lot of doubt. I mean, I would write and I was, you know, I think self-aware enough to know that this writing is not good writing. Like my first attempts, I was like, man, if this is it, if this is as
Yeah.
good as I get, it's never going to work. 'Cause this just doesn't feel like, you know, top level work here. And so
Yeah.
that's why it took me 2.5 years to write the first book, because I rewrote that book. I don't even want to think about how many times, but just, you know, reflecting on, you know, where do I need to improve my craft, and what, you know, what's working about this. But it
Yeah.
was a real learning experience. It was arduous. I mean, it was a tough time.
Did you have like that moment where you wanted to turn back? Like, forget it.
Probably a few. And I mean, probably, you know, at 4 o'clock on a lot of days, I was just like, oh, what am
Yeah.
I even doing? You know, and
Yeah.
I really got to a point where I was like, man, I've got to release this book to see if, you know, there's anybody out there and if this is going to work. And I mean, that's pretty much what I did.
Yeah. What was so, I mean, what were some of the hurdles, like creatively and professionally? What were you doing before you started this? What was the
Well,
job?
we had the last internet company we did was called Redemio, and it was this aggregator of daily deals. This
Okay.
completely dates my career.
Yeah,
I'd
yeah.
send you an email with all the Groupons and Living Social and whatever else in your. So if you were in some hot yoga around 2010, that, you know, maybe
Yeah.
helped you get in there for 50% off or something.
Like those
But
coupon books they sell you. Is it kind
yeah,
of like that?
it
Yeah.
was pretty much a digital coupon book. But
Yeah.
I mean, and then I was doing nothing, and that's when I started writing. I mean, I did that full time for, yeah, years.
Did you ever have moments where, because I've done this a time or two. There's moments where I kind of hit a wall and don't know how I'm gonna get past it. You know? Did you experience? What was it like starting out? Did you have moments like that?
Well, early on, I outlined the book very heavily because I was scared of
Oh.
this specifically. I was like, you know, terrified that I would write a lot of the book and the ending wouldn't be there. And it would just be like, oh, now I've really wasted my time. You know,
Yeah.
it's like, and I'm going to have to start over. I mean, it does happen to me still, you know, if I'm outlining or if I'm writing something and the book changes from the outline. And now I'm like, well, you know, there goes the outline. We've got to really rethink this thing. But it is, I mean, it's a common problem, I feel like. If you're conscientious about your work, it's a problem. I mean, some people are just like, oh, this doesn't work. I'm going to keep going with it. But I,
Yeah.
you know,
Yeah, what
it's.
do you do then? Like when you hit that point where you've diverged from the outline, do you stop and re-outline, or just is it pantsing it from that point on?
Well, I re-outline because I'm like,
Okay.
you know, because inevitably, well, first, I think my process has changed a little because of this issue we're talking about. Like, my first outlines were really, really detailed. And I found that along the way, I got to know the characters more, or some things that I thought were going to work just didn't on the page, didn't really feel
Yeah.
authentic or believable. And it's like, man, you know, this does not work. And so I'm going to change it. And so now my outlines are a little more broad. Like I do the research, and like I know what that is, and I know
Yeah.
who the characters are and what the story is. And then I sort of let things evolve. And then it's like an iterative process where you say, all right, this is where the story is going. How do I adapt to that? And let's see what I think the big thing is opportunities come up and you're like, oh man, that is a lot better idea than what I
Yeah.
outlined or what I was planning to do. So I'm not going to do the thing that is not as good as this just because I was, you know, it's on this outline. I'm going to
Yeah.
go do the better idea. And I think that's what It creates a lot of the work, but it's all
And
right.
so from that point, I mean, since you're re-outlining, I mean, how has the initial outline process changed through this? Like, does this re-outlining thing that you do you go in knowing that you're probably going to do that? And does that change anything about how you initially
It
outline?
does. Yeah. And I think it, I mean, the outlines are a little more broad. And they're, I think allow for this sort of discovery process or whatever you would call it. But yeah.
I like discovery. Just that's my
That's the
method.
new term, isn't it?
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's what it is.
Makes it sound less like you're just making it up, you know?
It sounds more professional
It does.
than pantser. I need to stop saying pantser. So, I know that there was a big moment. I've always been curious to ask you this, and I'm sure that you've answered this question a million times. But what was that? There was a breakthrough defining moment for you with this, because you blew up at that time with Atlantis Gene. By the way, I have to keep myself from saying Atlantis Riddle, which is
Just
my
thinking
book.
Atlantis Riddle when you were saying it.
And we should tell the story, because I told you about this at Author Nation that I completely did you wrong out there, because as soon as you blew up, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to write a thriller novel called The Atlantis Gene, or no, The Atlantis Riddle, and capitalize on this guy's phenomenal success, which kind of sort of happened, but didn't quite happen.
Well, rest assured, I was unharmed. So it's all good. I don't know what was my breakthrough moment. I mean, the book really. I mean, I felt like when the book came out March of 2013, I did feel like this was the best I could do. Like I felt like I had done some good work on the book, and I felt confident, like I'm giving this my best shot. But I didn't have any. I had no experience in the publishing industry, period. Like I knew a lot about the internet and like selling something on the internet. Like that, I mean, that is also one of the things that led me to self-publishing. And I really wanted to hear from readers to figure out if I had something, if I should be doing it. And I think, the book really had a life of its own, like you said, like it, just continued with no advertising and no, I mean, I still, I'm not terribly social. My social media game is pretty weak. And then, like it just continued to just go and go and go. And I hired a professional editor that summer, David Gatewood, and rewrote a lot of the book and learned a lot from that. And I learned a lot from readers, like the readers who, in 2013, who wrote long reviews and pointed out things that objectively could be changed to improve that book. I incorporated it. And then the second book, The Atlantis Plague, came out in December. And I mean, it really sold a lot of copy. I mean, it was something wild just that month alone. I think that's when it really, arguably the peak of my career right there, that trilogy. But
I mean, how did that change? So how is your career different now compared to when those three books came out?
well, I think it's different in a few ways. One is, I mean, there's obviously, like I've written 13 novels in, what, 12 years, and I would say that when I went in that first novel, I really wanted to write a commercially successful novel. Like that was something that was really important to me, to give it a good chance of having success, because I knew that would motivate me. And I was looking at it as a career as well, as something that should that needed to make money to get me where I wanted to go. And I think today I think there's this balance between, what you want to write and what you're interested in writing and what you need to write, to sustain your life or your family or your career or whatever it is you need to do. And I think that balance has maybe shifted a little more for me towards the creative. I mean, I'm still writing books that are commercial in nature and I think have had good commercial appeal, but I'm, when I'm thinking through ideas, I'm a little more inclined to do things that are maybe of more interest to me.
How does that come about? How do you find the thing you're going to write about next?
I usually think like one of the toughest parts for me is like picking the idea. And I'm like, well, if someone else released this idea, this book about this idea tomorrow, like how would I feel? And I'm being like, if the answer to that is I'd be crushed, then that's probably the book I should be writing because that's, you know, what I'm on fire to work on. But that's kind of how I do it.
That's
The FOMO, I guess,
yeah, no, I like that
process.
approach, man. That's a great approach, you know, 'cause I don't think I have as great an answer to that question as you just gave, honestly. So what do you think, if you were to start describing your process to your readers, what about your whole creative process do you think your readers would find most surprising?
Well, I think I hope that readers would say that the novels seem very well thought out and plotted, and that, you know, everything seems, you know, by the time you get to the end, you realize things about the first half that are just shockers, that, you know, you get there, there's these big twists and these big ideas. But I think the reality is that, as we talked about, this discovery writing process, a lot of that, you know, you do the research and you think about the characters and the story, and then inevitably in the writing process, things change and you see opportunities. And so I think they'd be very surprised if they saw the initial outline and idea and concept and what the finished product is. It's a matter of doing the work to get to something, you know, as good as it can, as, you know, taking that idea and realizing its full potential in a novel, I think is work. But
That would be an interesting thing to release to your readers, actually. The, you know, show them what the original outline looks like compared to like what the end result was. That'd be kind of an, I think that'd be interesting. Maybe only writers would be interested in that.
and maybe
And
no one, but yeah, it'd be
maybe no
like
one. I would be.
iPhone pictures of a napkin and a bunch of Post-its and, you know,
Shoot, I'm all
coffee
over that, man.
rings.
Yeah, no, I'm all over it. So,
Yeah.
you know, once you sort of broke out and had success, you know, what was it that changed about your writing approach?
Well, I think I was like when I first started writing, I had a lot of ideas that I wanted to go after, and I actually think if the book hadn't, you know, had just been sort of less successful, I probably would have done more science fiction or probably veered more toward, you know, other ideas. But because I had had something that was really successful, I wanted to write something at that point in my career. I wanted to write books that were more in line, that I thought readers would like, because the expectations were pretty high. Like my fourth novel, Departure, which was a standalone, really was a bit of a departure from what I had written, but it was in terms of the way it felt and sort of this driving narrative of this big scientific mystery was essentially, I had hoped, something that the existing audience would like. So I think if you're lucky enough to build an audience, I think you have to think very critically about, you know, keeping those folks happy and balancing your happiness with what their expectations, you know.
I mean, has there been something that you thought, you know, I want to write this because my audience is going to love this, and then it didn't seem to hit the way you thought it would?
Yeah, there's been a few. I would say in certain, you know, well, quantum radio, which we were talking about before the thing, audio just didn't seem to do very well. I still don't really understand that, but I would say nothing stands out that was just like, man, that was a real bomb. And I mean, I think if you talk to any given reader who reads my work, they would say, all right, well, you know, this was my absolute favorite, and then but this one was just not for me. And I think that, you know, that's pretty natural, especially with, you know, my books have been, there is a little, there's some range there, you know. I mean, some are like Pandemic is more of a thriller and maybe a little less sci-fi. And incidentally, if you're going to release a book like that 3 years before a pandemic, just be aware that you're going to have some problems with advertising it. You're going to have people coming up accusing you of profiteering from the pandemic. Anyway.
I was going to ask, because I mean, I remembered that, during all that, I think didn't it have kind of a spike during the pandemic?
I mean, people were reading the book.
Yeah, I know, but yeah, you couldn't have predicted that, but man, talk about coincidence. I'm not coincidence, I guess. I mean, it's not that unheard of to write about a pandemic, but to call it pandemic and then to
Well, I mean, I wasn't feeling creative that day, but I couldn't come up with anything more.
it worked out great. I mean, it's kind of an argument for, name things what they are. You never know. So, did you have a lot of fallout from that? People actually accused you of trying to, profit off of that?
Yeah, one or two. It wasn't a lot, and I think the first time I saw it, I was just like, I think a little rattled, but then, you get used to it, I guess. But it's just like, man, the publication date is on Amazon. Like, it's right there. You
Yeah,
can see that it
exactly.
says
People
2017.
don't pay attention to that though.
They don't,
Like,
man.
I wrote a book called Hidden Persuaders, which was about people invading the basically kidnapping people off the floor of the Senate. And like 3 months later was January 6th. So I had interesting email.
Yeah, I bet you did. I bet you
So
did.
Maybe if I'd called it insurrection, I might have actually made more money on that book.
It's not too late to change it.
I could change it. Yeah, I don't know if I want to go that route, but as you've progressed here, I mean, what do you th when you're looking back, how do you think your work today compares stacks up to, when you first started?
God, I hope it's better. I think there, but with that being said, there is something about your early work that is just like, I don't know. I guess we all carry a little baggage in this career. You've just been kind of kicked around a little bit, and then you've got a lot of voices in your head and a lot of, you have, I think, conflicting interests to some degree as you go deeper in your career, that when you're starting out, everything is a lot more simple. Actually, it's a lot harder to get started than to, I think, sustain a successful career. But I think, it's a blank canvas. Like, you can define your brand. You get that first chance to make a first impression. And I think that, there's something very enviable about that. But I hope that the work is better, and I hope it still has the same passion behind, the first book, because a lot of that was, my passion for writing and reading, and just like the creative process is still something I really love, and why I still do this. But I don't know. I'll have to go read the reviews.
What do you think? Like, I don't know. I think I've danced around this and haven't actually asked you, like, what do you think that it was that made that first book hit? Like, why that one over anything else you could have released?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One, I do think that the timing of the book helps it immensely. And the timing, and then supply and demand, just simple market conditions, in sense of there weren't a lot of techno thrillers or sci-fi thrillers that were, that was a 500-page book. It was well priced, and it was, well produced, and it was of commercial value. So I think from a value standpoint, relative to traditionally published books by whoever it is, Douglas Preston or whoever was competing at the time, $9.99 or 50, $12.99 versus 99 cent or $2.99 or $3.99, whatever it was, it was good value for money. And then there was a lot of readers who, there was nothing much competing. But then I think that the book was fundamentally about an idea that people were interested in, genetic engineering, ancient civilizations, and those things were pretty hot back then. I mean, and I think it benefited greatly from having a mashup of both the ancient aliens and genetic engineering and sort of the pandemic aspect. So it was a book that crossed genres and pulled in readers from a couple of different genres at the right time, offering the right value. And I think that I like to think that the story delivered on the promise, and they, you know, there's pretty good read through on that trilogy, and it continues to be, you know, it's certainly not selling the number of copies it did, you know, 12 years ago, but it does okay.
Yeah. Still, it's still selling. I mean, it still shows up pretty high in the, I don't know what it's ranking right now in the Amazon store, but it's still there.
Yeah, we're still
What's
able to
the,
buy diapers here, so you know.
there you go. What's the current book? What's the newest thing out right now?
I guess it's Antarctica Station, but that's been
Yeah.
over a year ago. Yeah, it
Yeah.
was.
You're working on something new.
Yeah,
Hopefully.
I mean, I've got a book finished, but I keep kind of fiddling with the end, just thinking, I don't know. My problem is I had a better idea for the ending. And I was like, okay, I gotta go write this thing now.
That's tough. At
It's
least you had it before the book released. You know,
yeah.
the real kicker would be like, oh, that book's been out for a month and I got a better idea for the end.
Oh, that'd be torture.
Oh
Yeah. I
man.
mean, you gotta turn the page, if you will. It just if you know, once it's in the wild, oh man. I mean, I
See,
obviously the last gene, I did a ton of rewrites. I didn't change the ending, but
yeah. See,
yeah.
you could capitalize on that though. Just write the alternate ending and say, you know, for 99 cents, here's the alternate ending, you know.
Yeah, you can try it.
There you go. Yeah, that's cool, man. Yeah. What is your let's talk about the mechanics of this thing a little. Like what's your actual writing routine? Do you write every day?
I do. Oh, I try to. If I'm
Yeah.
drafting something, I really like to write every day. I find that if I don't, it's pretty frustrating, and I find that the work is not as good if I don't write every day. I get about anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. Like once I wake up, the morning time is my best time to write.
Yeah.
And then after, say, 2 to 4 hours, it's just not quite as good. So I'll just go and, you know, have lunch or, and then I try to do admin stuff in the afternoon. And I try to
Yeah.
keep up with the kids. I mean, I have a son in preschool. So, you know, seeing what my wife needs and inevitably like this stuff that comes up. And
Yeah.
that's kind of my day.
Yeah, everyone thinks that like once you hit you're on a bestseller list, suddenly, you know, you got robot maids and it's like
Yeah.
I still have to empty the dishwasher
Yeah, man.
every morning. So, yeah.
Exactly.
I want my robot maid. So the one you're working on now is this I mean, I'm assuming it's in the same genre. It seems like everyone I'm talking to right now has a book that's outside their like James
Oh,
Rowland's
really?
writing fantasy and stuff now, you know.
Oh, right.
And
This one is, yeah, I mean, it's a techno thriller. The book is called Labyrinth, and it's about a widowed Marine veteran who has tinnitus, and so he hears this ring in his ears, and when he hears the ring, he sees a sequence of numbers, and he figures out that he's not the only one seeing this sequence of numbers, and they lead to this global conspiracy.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's
All
been
right.
done 100 times, so you know, I'm just kind
Yeah, well, not quite that flavor. I mean, you
of
know,
I was kidding.
there's Lost. You know, they had the
Yeah.
whole numbers.
And we use them. I'm using the lost number sequence, so that should be
Are you
familiar.
really? That would be
No,
amazing. That would be amazing.
we've got
I
all new numbers, and they mean something else.
got you.
There's
That's
no
cool,
island.
man. There's no island. Yeah, I know. Lost ruined things for a lot of us, actually.
Oh.
Like, oh, you took all the tropes and you jammed them together in this thing that you didn't even pay off by the end.
Oh.
Yeah, well, cool, man. Well, we're gonna go ahead and have to wrap up, but when you got a projection on when that new book's
Oh
gonna
man.
be? You
Yeah,
still gotta come up,
the
you still gotta rewrite the ending 5 times, so
this is gonna get me in trouble. I thought it would already be out, but I have to coordinate with the well, I have to do this rewrite and then I have to coordinate with the audiobook publisher, but probably this summer, I would guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna squeeze in one more question here, because the way you just talked about that, like I want to know, because you know, clearly you have a process now of how a book is released, and you know, I'm curious, one, how that's changed from when you first started, and what is the process that you go through?
It's a good question. I'm probably like the worst person to ask because I I mean, if you talk to some of these romance authors and some of these other authors, I mean, their process is really good. Like they're very organized, and it looks like landing on Normandy. I mean, just like the things they got lined up, and they're just boom, boom, boom. And mine is just kind of like the first day of high school or something. I mean, you're a deer in the headlights. You don't know what you're doing. You've got a locker. You feel awkward. You know, it's like, so my process. This book, the audio rights were bought a long time ago, and then I have to give them time and see what they want to do. And then I pretty much just, I like to stagger the notifications. So I'll do, email the first day, and then maybe the second or something, I'll do like the social media posts, and then I do run ads for new releases. But I give it about 7 or 8 days before I start anything because I want the Amazon emails to hopefully come out and clear out a lot of the organic purchases, which basically sort of trains the algorithm on how to sell your book and who to show it to. And so hopefully you're going to get a lot more ad effective. That basically what email, social media, and then ads, and then I just try to stay sane that week, I never succeed.
Well, you'll get there. You
Yeah.
just keep at it, kid. All
Maybe in
right.
10 more years. I
Yeah,
mean,
10 more years. All right. Well, where can anybody find you in this new book when it comes out? Where's the best place?
AG Riddle. Yeah, agriddle.com. A
AGriddle.com.
Griddle. Yeah.
All right, man. All right. Well, thanks. I'm glad we finally got a chance to chat.
Me too. Yeah,
All
thanks for
right.
having me on.
So my first question is for you, JD, and that is, do you have a robot maid yet?
We do not. I'm keeping a very close eye on the Tesla robot for when it gets to that stage. But no, I mean, at this point, like we've got a robot dog and we've got a real dog, and a real dog spends half his day chasing the robot dog and barking at it. And when he's not doing that, he's chasing the robot vacuums and barking at those. So more robots in our house, I think, would
You're
be a bad idea.
one robot made away from being the Jetsons. So you're
Yeah,
very close.
probably. If it existed, I would get it in a heartbeat, but
I mean,
they're
it
not there yet.
exists. It's just, I think we've got just a tiny gap before that sort of
You
thing
know
is.
what is honestly slowing me down on it? Like if you watch all the videos, what do they call it? Optimus, I think. That thing looks heavy as hell. And I spent a fortune putting really nice hardwood floors in our house, and I don't want a robot trudging through here destroying our
So
hardwood
you put
floors.
it in sneakers, man.
Yeah, I don't know. Did anyone watch like the robot soccer thing? That was hilarious. Watching robots, and they just fell everywhere.
The one that alarms me is how they're training it to do kung fu.
I
Like,
saw that.
why do we want
Yeah.
this? This isn't something we want. This is a bad idea.
Bodyguard.
Well, in case if it drops its gun, like it needs to be
Yeah,
able to
if it
defend
drops the
itself.
gun, it's got to be able to take me out by
Don't you
hand.
want a bodyguard?
Yeah.
I'd like a
Bodyguard.
I don't need no stinking body. I need protection from the damn robot is what I need.
Wow.
So Riddle said that he started out more confident as a storyteller than as a writer. Do you think focusing on story over prose early on helps or hurts a writer's development?
Helps.
Helps.
Yeah, it
Always,
definitely
always
helps.
story over prose. Always.
That's interesting though.
I think the people who tend to make it are the ones who have an instinct for story. But I think that a lot of people believe that the writing is more important, and that's it. Writing is just largely mechanical in a lot of ways. Like you can write a gorgeous sentence and have it be perfect, and but if you can't tell a story, then it doesn't
That's
matter
right.
how good your prose is.
I agree.
I believe there's a storyteller gene, and some people have it and some people don't. And in order to write books, you need to have that gene, and anybody can be taught the mechanics, the grammatic stuff, anybody can be taught that portion, but you can't be taught how to tell a story.
Well, and I was thinking about this the other day. This is why I'm not so worried about AI taking over writing and booting me out of a career. And that is, humans can improve like through repetition, through practice. The AI can only improve through training and training on someone else's work. And so the innovation happens though in that practice. Like you discover, you know, if I, you know, word this way, change this phrasing, change this rhythm, you know, it makes it feel better. And they don't get that feel. But, you know, I think, you know, it's funny because when Jerry started all the early interviews, like he did an interview with Nick Thacker where Nick asked him, like, you know, what do you think the secret is here for the bestseller success? And Jerry's answer was, you know, write a good book, and which made us want to strangle him at the time. Sorry, Jerry. I think he's right though, is write a good story, and you worry about, you know, polishing it and making this getting better at the skill of writing later, you know, focus on a good story first.
Well, I think that's why the advice, write a first bad draft and write a first bad book. You know, like if you want to write books, you know, because a lot of that is like if you sort of have that instinct for story, and if you read a lot, I think that that's something that you just kind of absorb naturally anyway. And so all the rest are just, you know, where to put the right scene and, you know, where to, you know, the plot beats and all of that stuff. And that's just practice. I mean, you just have to do it.
Write a bad book, make a really good edit. So he talked about shifting from, you know, he started with like rigid outlines, and then he's become more of a discovery writer. So have you ever had an outline just completely fall apart, and did it make the story better or worse?
You know, I've been moving more toward in the opposite direction. I find that every new book I start, the outline gets bigger and bigger, and then it tends to stay more stable because the outline is almost like a draft zero at a certain point. And so the problems are discovered in the outline. So by the time you sit down to start writing, it's not as much.
I've been outlining since I started writing with Patterson, and one of the things that I learned very early on is that that outline can't be rigid. It's got to be fluid. So it gives you a framework when you start the book. But like we constantly come up with ideas to tweak the story. So we make it a habit to go through, you know, when we want to make a change and we update the outline. So we're updating the outline ahead of the writing process all the time. So we don't go off into the weeds. You know, we always make sure that outline stays dynamic, which I found to be very helpful, because when I first tried to outline, you know, years back before I decided I was going to be a pantser forever, you know, I thought that that outline was kind of carved in stone. And then, you know, when I did go off into the weeds, then I just chucked the outline and just finished the story. But I'm finding that it's much better to just keep the outline dynamic. So you come up with that thing that would make you go off into the weeds, then you adjust the outline based on that, and then you just keep going. So it just gives you that framework.
Let me run this by you, JD, since that's your experience. Do you think it would be better or beneficial if you just mapped out like the major plot points, like beginning, middle, and end kind of stuff, without, you know, getting into the meat of it, but then you outline maybe two or three chapters at a time as you go? Do you think something like that would work?
You can, and I've done that. I think it's important to have those benchmarks in your head. You know, like as you're writing, I think you need to know what the ending is before you write that first page, because it gives your subconscious a target. You know, so one way or the other, you're going to get there as long as you have that there. If you start without that, then you've got a problem. Having a, you know, an idea of a couple things in the middle is helpful too. I find that even, you know, going that route is still more difficult than having, you know, a chapter by chapter outline, you know, for the entire book. And I find that I'm able to plot a lot more intricately if I have an outline for the rest of the book. The repetition goes away. You know, I you know, all the problems that I've seen in, you know, in people that are pantsing, and even my own work when I pants, tend to disappear if you keep that outline current and you follow it.
I've been with my outlines, been going bigger too, because I always find myself short. Like now I'm shooting for 70, 80 scenes outlined, you know, to get to that word limit, because I'm a bit of an like an underwriter. So I need 70 or 80 scenes outlined before I start writing, or I know I'm going to be short on word count. So That's been interesting.
Yeah, well, it comes in handy for that too, because I actually had the opposite problem. I used to always overwrite. Like every one of my books would end up 140 to 160,000 words, and I have to take stuff out. But when I've got that outline on paper, I know if I've, you know, X number of chapters is going to equal X number of words, and I can keep it right on track. The last couple books I've written have landed right in the 80 to 90,000 word count, you know, which is, you know, a sweet spot for me. That's where I've always wanted it to be. So it helps on that front too.
Yeah. Right, I'm going to ask one more question and we'll wrap up.
Okay.
And this is one I'm curious about. So he talked about how he picks ideas based on what would devastate him if someone else wrote it. So how do you decide what you're going to write next? And have you ever second-guessed your choices?
I second-guess every choice
all the
every day over the course
of I'm second-guessing even sitting down for this chat.
I don't know. I kind of pick like, well, I always start off really excited. Like, oh, this is like, oh, I'm so excited to write this. This is going to be so much fun. And then, you know, I quickly regret all of my life choices. And then I get excited again. And then I regret life. And then I get excited again. And hopefully I end excited.
Yeah.
It's a roller coaster for me.
For me, when I have some ideas, when I've got something I'm excited about and I'm like, maybe I should write this, I pitch it to someone else and watch how they react to it. Mostly to my husband, because he hates everything. So if he likes it, then I usually know it's a good idea. He's like, oh, that's kind of interesting, because I usually get an eye roll. But I'll pitch it to like a couple people and they're like, oh, that's really cool. I would read that.
Yeah.
Then I know I've probably got something. And if they're like, oh, yeah, and I get that kind of fake laugh. I'm like, okay, not that one. That's not the one to write.
Yeah.
I keep a working list of all the ideas I want to write. And then whenever I'm ready to sit down and talk to my agents and figure out what they think I should do next. My film agent has been huge when it comes to that, because he comes out of these pitch meetings for projects totally unrelated to mine, but like the studios will tell him what they're looking for. He communicates that stuff to me. So, you know, we're shooting for things that they might want to buy, you know, 6 months to a year down the road.
Yeah.
Having that inside, you know, scoop is very helpful.
Yeah,
that is helpful.
Secret weapon, get an agent.
Can I pitch my ideas to your agent?
Get a good film agent.
All right.
Yeah.
I guess with that, I'll just ask JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Thomas Oida Hoijveldt coming on. Thomas is an international best-selling author from the Netherlands and his first translated author to win the Hugo Award. He wrote one of my favorite books called Hex a few years back. I absolutely love that one. His latest is called Darker Days and releases October 28th.
Yeah, it's going to be a really fun conversation. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.